and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. Today, we continue our month-long series of presentations from the Arctic Imperative Summit hosted by the Alaska Dispatch. This week, Alaska's fisheries, the Bering Sea, and the Arctic, with the Honorable Clem Tillion, former chairman of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and Morgan Crow, executive director of the Coastal Villages Regional Fund. Then in the second half of the program, an update on the U.S. presidential election with Chris Matthews, host of Hardball with Chris Matthews on MSNBC. Publisher of the Alaska Dispatch, Alice Rogoff, served as host of the four-day summit recorded at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood, August 24th through the 27th.
Hello, I hope you can all hear me. At the risk of being rude, I'm asking you all to try and take your seat. So we're going to start it right now, even though a few more people will be slipping in a door during Clem's speech, for which I apologize in advance. Honorable Clem Tillion, on my right, one of the sagest, most knowledgeable people in the state of Alaska on, I dare say, many subjects. Former Commissioner of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, nine-term legislator from both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and of course the resident who thought of the vision for Halibut Cove. For any of you in this room who don't know about Halibut Cove, go there. That's all I need to say. Clem, come educate us, please.
Ladies, gentlemen, visitors from distant places, including my former motherland of the United States, I am first and foremost an Alaskan, kind of the ghost of Christmas past. While I was in the old Commonwealth Party, I didn't want statehood, I wanted Commonwealth. I love the flag, I could take your government and you know where you could put it. We are 62% of all the fisheries in the United States of America, and it wasn't by accident. We have eight times more salmon than we had when we took over from a failed federal system in 1959. All I can say is from years of dealing with the federal government that they hate success. They want everybody to be like New England and desperately in need of help. The trouble is that Alaska has handled their resources very well. We're listed with Iceland, New Zealand, and Alaska being the three places in the world that manage their fisheries well. I hear my federal talk about wanting ecosystem management, and then they make particular parts of the ecosystem sacred so you can't do it. But basically, I was lucky enough to be there when it began. My hero, the man I followed, his philosophy was Clarence Anderson, who was our first commissioner of Fish and Game. He died shortly after statehood. But he's the one that met his area management biologist right after statehood, and he'd been at the Constitutional Convention, slipped a few things into our Constitution for the protection of resources. And he said, gentlemen, and they were all male at that time, the six management biologists, the governor has instructed me to return Alaska's salmon runs to their former abundance regardless of the pain inflicted on the people. And I want you to understand that you are to fill every stream to the maximum capability of it. But if you allow an overescapement, thus depriving fishermen of their livelihood, you can expect to be criticized. But on a personal level, gentlemen, if you allow an underescapement, you can expect to be fired. And that is why we're 62% of the fish of the United States. Now, there are different ways of managing fish. The sports fish ethic is maximize the resource, maximize the opportunity of individuals to participate therein. But if you really think that the public owns the resource, the commercial mantra should be a quality product to the consuming public at a competitive price. It should not be run for the benefit of any particular segment of that society, but for the overall benefit of those that own the resource. And in the end, that's beneficial to the ones that come thereafter. I was involved in a lot more than just fisheries. I was president of the Senate when our permanent fund came up, and Governor Hammond, a close friend of mine, says, get me that bill, the investment bill. So I looked, and the presiding officer had subpoena powers, so I had the state troopers arrest two senators, slap them in handcuffs and bring them to the floor in handcuffs and discharge them. Appointed myself and passed the bill. And Hugh Malone saying, now, Clem, I want to explain how it works. And I said, it's 11:15. The governor's waiting upstairs. Can we just sign the damn thing? So Hammond used to say he didn't know who invented it, but he knew who the midwife was. All I am saying is that we will manage our resources well, but we are not bleeding hearts. I would harpoon a whale as quick as I would harvest a king salmon if the whale was surplus to the needs of its species, and protect it vigorously if it wasn't. I look at some of the tender things that people, too much of our fisheries management throughout the United States is a matter of the heart. There are many people that think Walt Disney is the final word on fisheries management. I'm looking forward. I'm like one of those that is bucking the trend. Do I believe in global warming? Yes. I'm afraid of ocean acidification more so. And people say, well, what was the average in the past? And I said, well, we date everything from the birth of Christ. So why don't we take the year one? And what was the Arctic Ocean like in the year one? Well, there was no second year ice. There's one village west of Baffin Island that had an estimated 1,600 people in it, several that were over 700. The northern Canadian archipelago was pretty well settled. And in the year 600, the little ice age began. People don't realize that the Vikings were in Greenland before the Eskimo, not after. The whole world changed. The Baltic Ocean froze shut, and about 600, and by 700, the Eskimo were all the way down to Prince William Sound. It was run or die. And it lasted till about 1825, and it's been steadily warming ever since. And to think this is going to change is utterly ridiculous. We're coming back to normal. And I look forward to the day that I can ship my codfish from Adak, Alaska, directly to the Portuguese market through the Northwest Passage, saving a couple of thousand miles. So I'm one of those that are enthusiastic about the melting. On the other hand, there are going to be some serious drawbacks. We talk about Alaska was very lucky in that when they made the deal with the Tsar drawing the line, we ended up with the most productive parts of the Bering Sea. We ended up with the shallow water. The Russian side has the deep water, which produces less. So we've got truly the best part of the Bering Sea. That's not true when we come around the corner above Port Lay. That area there might be very productive for the oil industry, but it's not going to be a great producer of resources, living resources, though who knows what it'll come to. People say, well, what will it be like when the Arctic Ocean is open and the seas roll all the way in from the other end of the Arctic Ocean and pound in? I said, we'll take a look at Yakutat and Yakutaga. It'll mean big sand dunes and sloughs and lagoons behind it. We will adjust. And to think that this great fear of something that you're not going to be able to stop or control is idiotic. What we need to do is plan on what will happen, not what we want to happen. It is going to be open, we're going to need to adjust to it. As far as the Eskimo people, they've adjusted to so many drastic changes you can't hardly believe it. But the thing that I do always look at with our oil is to treat it as part of your economy is to court disaster. It, by its very nature, is a temporary enclave within this state. I'm a great defender of the permanent fund as a way in which it's only got $40 billion. If we'd done wisely like Norway did and put 100% of our bonuses and royalties in, we'd have $480 billion. They put all of theirs in, and they have $780 billion in theirs. It'll be able to support their government after the oil is no longer there, so they're not subject to it. But Walter Levy, who we hired, oil consultant, when we hit our first $900 million, said, remember, 100 years from now, the only person that will see Prudhoe Bay will be an Eskimo looking for a caribou. And by its very nature, it's going to pass, and unless we convert it to something that lasts longer, we in Alaska will be making a major mistake. I think that I'm invested fairly heavy at ADAC. I call it my southern home. It's south of Prince Rupert, British Columbia. And I have a duplex out there at the old naval base. And sometimes when it's a little cold and blustery in the Gulf of Alaska, I go out there where it's still in the 30s. And you know, as I love ADAC, the cod average 27 pounds of fish trawl run. That's 75 or 80-pound fish. I haven't seen that since I was a kid on the Grand Banks. I'm also one of those people that know how to set longline gear from a dory. It's a useless skill, thank God. It was a crummy way to make a living. I'm also one of those that doesn't dream about the good old days. I had the good old days. All they remind me of is the last steamer left for Seattle in October. Another one didn't come back till April. You bought your groceries once a year. Your wife hemorrhaging after a baby and no doctor. Having a couple of teeth taken out with a sharp knife and a chisel. Thank you. I like today. And I feel that our state will do the right thing with many mistakes. We all make mistakes. I would like it to be more like somebody that said, man learns from his mistakes, and a fellow called Otto von Bismarck turned rather coldly and said, no, a fool learns from his mistakes, a wise man from the mistakes of others. So there's an awful lot that we could learn from what somebody else has stumbled with. The Norwegians were very lucky. They could come over and look at our permanent fund and then go what Vernon Smith, the economist, says we should have done to begin with and put it all in there. I was the lone vote in the state Senate against repealing the income tax because I don't think that anybody should get anything for nothing, that everybody should pay their share, and that we shouldn't get a free ride. But all in all, Alaska has done quite well with the resources we were given. We are the only land-grant state in the United States. We had difficulty with statehood. In fact, we kind of turned it down the first time. The basic thing was, after some negotiations, Alaska was given the 3 million acres that goes with statehood plus 100 million acres like a land-grant college. And that is what we live on. And we're the only, and so the thing is that when an Alaskan talks about my oil, that's what he means. It's his oil. The oil and the resources and the minerals below the subsurface are held in common by the people of Alaska. And it's not a case of them saying to me, well, you're a Republican, you don't believe in taxes. I said, I'm a Republican, I don't believe in giving my clients resources away for nothing. They said, well, what will you do with all that money? And I said, that's not your business. I would rather have an annual burning of the dollars in Anchorage each year than let you keep it when it's not yours. And so what we've been charged for with more than anything else is to take what we have received wisely. People ask me, do I support Pebble Mine? It was one of the, when Bill Egan, who I admire, chose a commissioner of public resources, Phil Holdsworth, who another Chuck Herbert was his mining man, and they went out to corner every valuable piece of property they could get in that 100 million acres they were given. Prudhoe Bay was one of them. The Pebble Mine area was another. And somebody asks, are you for it? My first question is, what does Alaska get out of it? When I went to Juneau, we got 1.6% for oil. The Swanson River field, which was the first one to come in, brought the people of Alaska absolutely nothing for their resource. By the time Prudhoe Bay came around, we'd been able to push through 12.5% royalty and whatever taxes were necessary to manage the resource, which is about 20%. I'm not one of those that feel that anybody should get something for nothing. In fact, when Terry Gardner was Speaker of the House and I was President of the Senate and Hammond was in the catbird seat, we raised fish taxes 300% so that they would have to pay for the enforcement and the management themselves. That's more than you can say for the tourist industry. We spend about $7 for every dollar we get back from that one. And there's two lines of thought with people. There's the Chamber of Commerce position, which is maximize the population and therefore the customers that serve you. And there's the position of the state itself, or should be, which is what do my great-grandchildren get out of it? Are you going to manage the resource so there's another one to have? I realize that I'm supposed to cut this saying somewhat short. I'd like to amuse you with some other things. Today, when they were talking about the Healy, I read history for the fun of it, and I admire Mike Healy's father more than you could even imagine. He was a Georgia planter that fell in love with a mulatto girl, and instead of trying to fight the system, he just bought her. And he raised all his children by her. And he sent them north, and they all became very successful. And among the one of them was a young man that graduated from the academy and became a captain under the Revenue Marine, which was the early things. And Roaring Mike left quite a legacy in Alaska. The natives liked him. At one time, they were off of Point Hope while the natives were on summer camp, and some of his men picked up a few things in the native houses. He found about it and turned around and brought the Corwin, it was then, back, anchored it off and under Marine Guard, had each one of them go ashore and put it back where they'd found it, plus a gift, and then he chained them by the ankles till they got to San Francisco. He said, "You don't know how much I despise anyone who'd steal from those who have so little." But he was a bit brutal at times, and it's what it took in the time of the whaling fleet and the tough times. And so I hate to see that pass, because not only was he one of the finest Coast Guardsmen we ever had, he was one of the finest human beings we ever had. He became not only the last captain of the Corwin, the first captain of the Bear, and I could go on with a lecture on that one. And all I'm going to say tonight is, thank you for the time you're given. Among when I was fish czar for Wally Hickel in charge of all fisheries policy in the state, he gave me two orders. I want fresh fish on the table at the Captain Cook year-round, and it is unconscionable to leave the people of the Bering Sea standing on the beach while somebody else takes the resource. Get them involved. And I said, and he said, can you do it? And I said, yes, if you can take the heat. This isn't going to be very pleasant, because the people that already have it aren't going to like what I'm going to do. And when I went to Kodiak to explain what was going to happen, they had a police escort for me. And In fact, the joke in Dutch Harbor, when somebody said, "I'd like to put one through his heart," somebody said, "His what?" And another guy in the back said, "If I ever wanted a heart transplant, it's Tillions I'd want. He's never used it." But that isn't true. It's just that I had children and grandchildren, and I now have great-grandchildren, and there shall be something left for them. And if we're not stopped by our own government, that's the one in Washington, we will succeed in doing it. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with the Honorable Clem Tillion, former chairman of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. He was recorded speaking at the Arctic Imperative Summit on August 25th. Following Clem Tillion, Morgan Crow, executive director of the Coastal Villages Regional Fund, spoke on the same topic, Alaska's fisheries, the Bering Sea, and the Arctic.
I guess this is the second time that I've wanted more from Clem, and he's been cut off. But the first thing that I need to warn you is the police escort that he talked about was to guard them from him. The first summer that I came to Anchorage to work, Clem was brought in to talk to us, and he was telling us a lot of things that we didn't know. It was just like his directive tonight to educate us, and he began to do that, just that, and he said he had a plane to catch, so he had to cut it short and head down to Halibut Cove, and I asked my boss if I could drive him to the airport just to keep the conversation going. And 14 years later, he's got a big brain to pick, and I want to know more. So thank you, Clem, and many more years, right?
Just do a good job.
All right. My name is Morgan Crow, and I work for Coastal Villages Region Fund. And I arrived here tonight and saw the sign that says that we had sponsored dinner. I didn't know about the dinner. I think there's somebody running this company the right way. But if it was me, I would have said we all have to order McDonald's number 11, which is the Pollock fish sandwiches. So we are in the business in the Bering Sea, and I want to describe a little bit about our story and see if I can relate it a little bit to the Arctic. In an early conversation with Alice Rogoff, she had talked about her concern for certain program benefits that were not being delivered to the people intended. And this was just an open conversation where she was explaining her caring for those people. She said that she supported people to make local decisions, and I think that it's clear to all of us here that Alice cares a lot about Alaska and its people. And I hope that she can see that the story of Coastal and her caring for the people have similar roots, which has a lot to do with power for the people. Before I get into my comments, I'd like to thank Catherine Stevens for providing a lift for a couple of the guys, and I need to report right off the bat that everybody is okay. There's a few cuts and bruises and a fair amount of ibuprofen going around, but everyone's resting well, as I understand it. Our company, Coastal Villages Region Fund, has a board of 20 individuals elected by its communities. There is a democracy going on in our company, and it's been that way since the beginning. There were supposed to be about 15 of my board members here tonight, but I think we're down to about 5. Welcome. Thank them for dinner. They make good decisions. So our villages are within 50 miles of the Bering Sea coast, from Scammon Bay in the north, south to Platinum. We have about 9,300 people along about 300 miles of the coast. We got our start in the CDQ program, the Community Development Quota Program. I think Clem, of course, had a lot to do with it, and he made some segue comments there. So thanks to Clem and his gang for getting this thing started. And clearly, the way Clem described it, it wasn't always that way. That CDQ and 10% of the tax, the total allowable catches from the Bering Sea, are allocated to those villages. When things got underway in the Bering Sea in the early 60s, there were no U.S. vessels, let alone Western Alaskans involved. It took over a decade until 1976 before the United States asserted jurisdiction out to 200 miles and took control over that fish. It took another couple decades until 1992 before our villages were allocated any of the fish and allowed to participate in those fisheries. And then it took another couple decades until right now before any Western Alaskan villages gained control of any Bering Sea fishing operations. There's an enormous difference between participation and control. In the fisheries, participation means somebody else in Seattle or Japan has control and keeps most of the money, even when the quota belongs to us. Control means that our villages keep everything we make. Control also means that if something goes wrong, it's our own fault, and when things go right, people get the full benefit. Things are going right for coastal villages. In 2011, we became the first CDQ group to own and control 100% of the vessels that catch our quota in the Bering Sea. We sold over $100 million in seafood in 2011, making us the largest 100% Alaskan-owned seafood company in history. We employed 1,100 people and paid them over $30 million in 2011. We are the largest employer in our entire region, providing more opportunities to work than even the government, primarily at our in-region salmon and halibut operations. We're the only major seafood processor in Alaska that hires mainly Alaskans. On average, more than 90% of our processes are Alaskans, and just over 80% come from our own member villages. Over the last 14 years, our balance sheet has grown from zero to just over $300 million. During that same 14 years, we've pumped over $250 million into our communities through jobs, infrastructure, and other economic activity. We've spent over $100 million in our villages in just the past 4 years alone. Coastal's most recent Bering Sea investment was historically significant in that it was a fleet of vessels owned by a Seattle family that has been active in the Alaska fisheries ever since statehood, before statehood, for about a century. Some say that Coastal Villages is finally decolonizing the Alaskan fisheries from the Seattle pioneers. Some people remember that Seattle's control over our fisheries drove the effort to gain Alaska statehood. The Seattle Times is worried about our plans to move the Alaska fishing fleet to Alaska after a century of being based in Seattle. All of this by giving our 20 villages just 2.4% of the Bering Sea pollock fishery and even less of the cod, crab, and flatfish. With the other five Western Alaska CDQ groups, we are allocated 10% of the fish. So just think about the value of the other 90% of the resource. My advice for the Arctic is to give the nearest human being some control over the Arctic resources even sooner than happened in the Bering Sea. Seattle and Japanese companies were given the majority of the other 90% of the Bering Sea, and we are now having to buy it back from them. In the Arctic, there's still time to give people along the coast a place at the starting line, enable them to be initial recipients of the resources rather than an afterthought. In the Bering Sea, it was 30 years before we were given the chance to participate, and another 20 years, nearly a half a century, before our villages have begun to gain control. That other 90% of the Bering Sea continues to represent billions of dollars that leave Alaska each year. There's no need to explain to this group how indigenous involvement helps all participants, You already know. If you're a greenie, your goal is to mobilize the indigenous people to fight against development and to fight to keep the things the way they are. If you're an industrialist, you want the locals to participate so they will support the economic development and change. Either way, everybody wants the people nearby to participate. Well, if the people most affected can just get some control of the resource, they can decide for themselves the balance between development and conservation. In the Bering Sea pollock fishery, we have Chinook salmon bycatch. Chinook are very, very important to Western Alaskans. Because the Coastal Villages Board controls our pollock boats, we had the power to ship all of our Chinook bycatch to Anchorage earlier this year. We had the power to work with a nonprofit called SeaShare to make sure that every pound of Bering Sea salmon bycatch gets used in food banks in Alaska. And most importantly, we have the power to park the pollock boats if the 9,300 people who elect our board decide that Chinook bycatch levels are unacceptable. Our villages seem to be happy so far. In 2011, we killed just over 300 Chinook while catching and processing and selling over $50 million worth of pollock on our 100% Alaskan-owned catcher-processor vessel. By comparison, single families in our region take more in Chinook for subsistence needs in a given year. Our elected board is willing to sacrifice the kings that have been needed to catch our pollock. But if they were not, they have the ability to do something about it, to park the boats that they own and control. It has been very interesting to the board members, some of whom are here tonight, to realize that the control they have fought so hard to get is a threat to both the fishing industry and to the environmental community. Both of these groups of outsiders lose standing as the actual people who live along the coast gain control. Our residents don't have the luxury of living somewhere else, so they must demand an honest discussion. They must demand the best science, and they must demand the truth. We face the direct consequences of what happens in the Bering Sea. We have to understand what's real and what's not, whether it's from the industry or the environmentalists. Believe me, it's a good thing. It would be good for those around the Arctic Ocean, too. There's a lot of uncertainty about the future of the Arctic, but I'm certain that the indigenous people along the Arctic coast can handle the responsibility, and I'll bet you that Alice agrees with me. Thank you very much.
At the risk of wading into fish politics, all I want to say is, Morgan, that was a great speech. And I think you've raised the issues that are the top of mind for everybody in this room and probably everybody in Juneau when they get back down to business. Okay, as Chris Matthews said I should say, here comes dessert, meaning that Chris is the first to admit that he is not here to talk about the Arctic. Why? Because like all good Washingtonians, he doesn't know much about the Arctic. But unlike many pundits and talking heads, Chris is an honest man. And I know this about him because he and I go back to days long by. I think it was actually 74, 75. Chris worked for a certain Speaker of the House by the name of Tip O'Neill. I worked for a member of the House who shall go unnamed, because if I told you good Alaskans who it was, you'd think I was a nutcase for life. We all do things when we're young and irresponsible, as they say. In any case, that's how far back Chris and I go, and so I know that while he knows nothing about the Arctic, he's smart enough that he wants to know about the Arctic, And therefore, he was willing to make the trip all the way here to be among this esteemed crowd of people who are not just Alaskan, but from all countries focused on the Arctic. However, he's coming to talk to us about politics, which is his stock in trade, and I dare say I have never heard Chris say anything about presidential politics that anybody else has said first. And that's always been the standard that I use for deciding whether it's worth listening to someone, and that is how good their original thinking is. So with that as background, I just think we're going to learn something tonight. Now, Chris is walking up here wearing a bolo tie that was just given to him by Representative Bob Herron, wherever you are, Bob. Bob said, I'm going to give it to him as a gift if he'll wear it. Well, duly noted, he's wearing it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being here. Mr. President, Mr. Secretary, Governor, I always call Lieutenant Governor, Governor, call Assistant Secretary, Mr. Secretary, get it right. And it's great to be up here. Alice and I go way back, and I want to ask, first of all, a show of hands, how many Republicans are here tonight? And how many Democrats here tonight? I like you already. How many independents? How many state, what do you call it? How many people here want to see Alaska's own country? Yeah, I thought, I recognized the idiom. I sensed it. Look, I'm not going to, I am here to learn, not to talk about your the state of Alaska and all the things you're, and I am already hit by the my massive ignorance on yet another subject, but there are things I know, so bear with me. I do only think the way I think. I do not listen to other people. That's my problem. But I do have my own views of things. I want to say that, first of all, Alice is dead right. We first worked together back 45 years ago, believe it or not. We were professionals together, and we both worked in the office of the president in Washington. She worked in the office of OMB working to reduce the federal deficit, and I worked in the president's reorganization project attempting to reform and make the federal government more efficient. As you may know, these works go on today. They continue, these efforts. I have had a strange life. Like most young guys my age got interested in baseball. They had baseball cards. They knew all about the baseball, the third. I still watch ESPN. I listened. I said, how come everybody knows the third string quarterback on some team and what kind of a contract he has and how it should be shorter and how come he's getting? People know so much stuff about sports. Well, my interest has been in politics. So I have this weird interest in politics and how the two parties behave. And I've been watching them since 52. But also really more intensively since 60. Here's what I noticed about the two political parties, which will prove true this year, has already proven true, and will prove true right through the election as you watch it. It's sort of an anthropology of these political parties, as if they were in the South Seas somewhere in the South Pacific, and I was studying this weird island culture. I'm now going to talk to you about these political parties that way. How you doing? Son-in-law, how you doing? Thank you, David, by the way, for having it. There's David, too. Look. This is it. My first convention, I was listening to on the radio, and we used to listen to things on the radio in the old days, not just television, was the 60 Democratic Convention from Los Angeles. That was the one that nominated John F. Kennedy, of course. And throughout the proceedings, there was a woman with a high-pitched voice. She had the first glasses I ever saw on a chain, right? Like today, people have them very commonly. And she kept saying, will the delegates please clear the aisles? Now, she would say it all the time because it didn't have any effect. Democrats don't clear the aisles. Democrats do what they feel like doing now. At this moment, they do what they like to do now. And I noticed that she continued throughout the week saying, will the delegates please clear the aisles, to no effect, whatever. And then a week or two later, I watched the Republican convention, which nominated Richard Nixon in Chicago. And something really astounding happened. Just like at the Democratic convention, there was a woman with a high-pitched voice up at the podium who kept saying, actually, she only had to say it once, maybe twice, will the delegates please clear the aisles? And something unbelievable happened. They did. Republicans do what they're told to do. They go sit down when they're told to sit down because you're supposed to. You're supposed to. Okay? So the business can proceed, so the order can be restored. They want that to happen. They want to have a business environment. They know it's important to sit down when they're told to. That's how different they are. Democrats, as I say, do what they feel like doing. And this never changes. Will Rogers once said, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Republicans are different. They're very different. Depending on your loyalties, and I already know them now, having memorized everybody's face in their political party, depending on your loyalties, they're either docile or they're disciplined. A disciplined, oh, thank you. A disciplined, a Republican has spoken aloud. So I have a theory. Go to the movies. In fact, a friend of mine owns a movie up here at Homer, movie theater. Go to the movie theater and get there 10 minutes early and look around in the room and see who's there 10 minutes before the movie starts. Maybe there'll be people sitting there quietly, all settled in their seats, waiting for the movie to start, and they maybe have a candy bar in their hands. They're all Republicans. Every one of them's a Republican, okay? You don't have to ask their party label. They have already shown it. Now wait for after the trailers are through. Wait for the commercials they now have in the movies are through. Wait till the movie starts and it's deadly dark in the theater. Completely dark. And somebody starts pushing past you, without any kind of excuse me either, by the way, pushing past you with a giant trash can of popcorn and a jug as big as a house of Coca-Cola, pushing past you, mumbling something about, when did this thing start anyway? They are all Democrats. You know for sure they are. I belong to no organized political. When this thing start? It's so true. Exhibit, at every Democrat and Republican convention, they have a balloon drop. It's a big deal. It's a hokey-pokey political thing. But they always have all the balloons are up in the rafters. You know they're up there. And Republicans always have a great balloon drop. All right? They pull the string, and with the music, all the balloons come down. It's one of the most amazing things. I don't know how they do it. The balloons, Jim Baker is probably in charge of some of these. They bring the balloons down, you know? Forget the Middle East peace talks. This is important. The balloons have to drop it to prove you're a Republican. Every time the Democrats have tried to do something as idiotically stupid as a balloon drop, you look up all the TV cameras from all the networks, focus up into the attic, up there in the ceiling, and the rafters, they're all there. They don't come down. And then they start pulling the strings and nothing works. It's always pathetic. That's the Democrats. They can't do a freaking balloon drop because you know what? These balloons are Democrat balloons and they're not coming down. Okay, they do what they feel like doing. Now, how do they pick their candidates? And this is just exactly what I'm talking about, the way they pick their candidates. Okay, the Democrats are like an inner-city basketball court in a big city, you know, with the rims bent, there's no net, tough kids playing basketball. Who do they give the ball to? Who do they pick to go for the shot when the guy's got the hot hand? The kid, he may have just shown up on the basketball court, never saw him before, but this kid's got the hot hand. They feed him the ball. That's how Democrats are in picking presidential candidates all these years. Jack Kennedy, well, let me give you an example. In 1952 at the Democratic Convention, somebody that wasn't even running gave a really good speech. He was the governor, the home state governor of Illinois. He wasn't even a candidate in 52, but he gave a really, really good speech. His name was Adlai Stevenson, and they nominated him. They said, great, that's a hell of a speech. You're going to be our nominee for president. By the way, you're running against Dwight Eisenhower, just so you know what's going on here. And he just received the Nazi surrender, so it'll be a little rough. But you're going up against, you're our guy, because you just gave a hell of a speech. Jack Kennedy, Jimmy Carter, Jimmy who? Then let's run him. He's got a good rap. Let's go with him. Bill Clinton, little problems at home, but that's all right. We'll run him. Barack Obama, love that name, Barack Hussein Obama. That's a winner. Let's run him. First try, never saw the guys before. This is how Democrats behave. Phenomenal. I get thrilled by this guy. He runs. The Republicans could not be more different. They could not be more different. Republicans. I said the Democrats are like an inner-city basketball court. You pick the kid who's got the hand. You give him the ball. He shoots it. You make him the nominee. Just like that. You never knew him before. Totally phenomenal, phenomenal. It's his turn. Now, the Republican Party is totally different. The Republican Party picks people like this. Well, they picked Nixon in 1960 because it was his turn. He was VP. It's his turn. Remember that phrase. Whose turn is it? Like in a club. In 1968, they nominated Nixon again because it was still his turn. This is an exciting political party. And then Ronald Reagan in 1980, because he lost in 68, he lost in 76. In 1980, it was his turn. Okay. In 1988, Bush 41, your good friend, got the nomination because he lost to Reagan in 1980, and it was his turn, okay? In 1996, Bob Dole got the nomination because he lost not only to Ronald Reagan, he lost to Bob Dole 8 years later, and now it was his turn. And the beauty of it is they love these guys, the Republicans. He had 20 years before that, he'd been a nominee for vice president. It's a party of patience, of waiting your turn. There he is, backed by popular demand, Bob Dole. He's the guy to run against Bill Clinton. He'll beat him. Good luck. Okay, in 43, we have a legacy candidate. That's W. We got legacies. I forgot to mention, if you don't wait your turn, just like wait your son's turn, he'll come along, he'll get your turn. Okay, so you got a legacies in there, you know? You got to get a legacy in there, W. I can't think of any other selling point. Anyway, McCain, his turn came. He got beat to hell in South Carolina in 2000. He waited his turn. He's the nominee in 2008. This is a party of waiting your turn, not the hot hand, just a party of a club and waiting your turn. And so here we are, waiting their turn. And this is what happens. Since 1952, when I first started paying attention to politics, through 2004, with the exception of 1 year, there have been one of three names on every Republican ticket. Nixon, 52, 56, 60, 68, 72, Bush, 80, 84, 88, 92, 2000, 2004, and filling in the blanks, Bob Dole, 76 and 96. This is not a party of diversity. Three names. Anyway. The exception, of course, is when the Republicans went off the rail on 64 and nominated Goldwater and got crushed. Maybe that's why they go back to this wait your turn theory. It's safer. So Mitt Romney fits the pattern. Perfect nominee. He got beaten before. He waited his turn. And he's a legacy. Right? His father ran. He lost. Perfect. He meets both the requirements of patience and legacy. So Obama won because he gave the greatest speech of his life in 2004. And he got the nomination the next time because he gave a great speech. Nobody had ever heard of him before. The name Barack Hussein Obama. When I first heard that name, I said, that guy's never going to be president of the United States. So I heard the speech, and I said, he's my guy. So that's how it works. I'm a typical Democrat. I was thrilled. Democrats fall in love. Republicans fall in line. Democrats go for the exciting guy, even if he just showed up. Republicans are slower to like a candidate, but they're also more loyal to those if they lose. Now, this is another big difference in the two political parties. When a Democrat loses, the party tries to banish him forever. Where's Mike Dukakis? The reason we don't know is that no one has ever asked. No one's looking for him. Michael Dukakis was 17 points ahead this time in 1980 over George Bush. 17 points ahead, but he blew it, so Democrats kill their wounded. Okay? They kill their wounded. Al Gore had to go into a cave and grow a beard and just disappear. And he won, by the way. It wasn't good enough to have the most votes. This guy fixed that one. Anyway, it's a weird party. Democrats shoot their wounded. Republicans run them next time. What a party. What a patient, good party they are. So this year fits the historic pattern of the two parties right up to date. Right up to date. Republicans fall in line. They go with the guy whose turn it is. Was there any really seriously any doubt in all those primaries? We all covered them like the Pearls of Pauline. It's going to be the Pearls of Pauline. It's really going to be exciting. But did anybody ever think that Rick Santorum was going to be the nominee? Anybody really think it wasn't going to be Romney? Was this really that suspenseful? Or Newt? Give me a break. Newt has a past. I don't think he has a future, but that's all right. He's over at the zoo right now checking out the latest giraffe season. But Romney fits the pattern so strongly, I don't think it was a real fight. Barack Obama is the kind of phenomenal candidate like Bill Clinton, who's still phenomenal, and Jimmy Carter for a brief moment there, a year or so, and of course Jack Kennedy and Adlai Stevenson, Democrats fall in love with. They love these guys. They just love them. Republicans are much more disciplined. They know this is the guy, and they're going to get together on him. So the pattern. Here's how I think this general election could go, and I'm not sure how it's going to go. People say it's going to be close. I say, that's a prediction. 50-50. Oh, you know more than I know. It's going to be 50-50. How do you know it's going to be 50-50? This election is a jump ball. This is the most wildest political campaign. I don't think you can call it right now, but what I'm trying to do the next few minutes is try to call what I think are the possibilities and the patterns, and you can tell me which one you sort of have a gut for. If Romney wins, and I think he has a very good chance of winning this general election, a very good chance, because of the economy, obviously, and because he doesn't scare people. People are not afraid of him. A lot of people say, yeah, I can live with him. And that's scary for Obama's people, that Romney doesn't look scary. The other thing is they want an alternative. The voter goes into the voting booth really angry if one of the parties says, you don't have a choice. This other guy's no good. They want to know that when they end that voting booth, they've got power. That's one thing every voter wants. I want to be able to choose between somebody who's got some problems and some strengths, some problems and some strengths on the other side. But I want to make the decision. Don't tell me I can't vote for the other guy. Example, Ronald Reagan running against Jimmy Carter. Jerry Rafshian told me this a few months ago. He was the head of communications for Carter. The voters believed all the negatives on Ronald Reagan. He was too old, too erratic, too right-wing. But they said to the pollsters at the very end of the election, but that's not how we're making our decision. We're making the decision on the fact we think Carter's in over his head. And so the voter, all the ads you see in the campaign that really smack the other guy may have an impact, but they don't determine how the voter goes. Because the voter makes a decision about their own enlightened self-interest, the sense they have of what's good for the country and them. And that may not have much to do with the way they knew Bill Clinton had girl troubles. They still thought he was a better bet than the condition George Sr. seemed to be in at that time, who seemed to be a bit out of it. And I think that's how they make decisions, very pragmatically. So here's what. If Romney wins, I believe it will be because of this. This is my only profundity of the evening. This is something I'm sort of proud of, okay? It will be because the voters in the middle, who decide all these elections, believe both candidates, Romney and Obama, are to the left of where they're presenting themselves to be. It will be because people perceive Obama as a man of the left rather than the center left, because they have judged Romney to be a man of the center right, not of the right. Whatever deals or commitments Romney may have made in this campaign, he made a lot of them with the religious right, with the Hawks, with the Tea Party. If he wins, it will be because the voters assume, okay, made all those deals to get the nomination, but he's really a pragmatic man of the center. He's a business guy who will make pragmatic business decisions, and that's what we need. So I think if Romney wins, it will be that general perception. He's more moderate than he had to sell himself to win the nomination, and Obama is more left than he's presented himself. And I think that is the winning theme you want if you're a Republican, I think, to propound all through the debates and the conventions. If Obama wins, it will be because the people end up seeing him as a guy who inherited a lot of crap, a disastrous economy. He did logical things to try to fix it. They didn't succeed yet. People also will believe, who vote for Obama, a negative feeling towards Romney, which will be they don't think he's in human touch with the real needs of regular middle-class people, especially women and seniors, because they believe he's not in touch as a human being with those concerns. So if you're Obama and if you're Romney and you understand these will be the ways that you will lose or win, you're going to try to correct the problems that will lead you to lose and emphasize the ones that will get you to win. So the next couple months, including the conventions and debates, I think you're going to see Romney work to present Obama as a hard lefty. You're going to hear a lot of this starting with Chris Christie next week at the convention with the keynote. You're going to hear it all week with Ryan, who's an excellent speaker, saying that Obama is way over to the left, way over there. And that Romney is not as right-wing as Ryan, but he'll say he's in alliance with him, but he's the pragmatic leader of the ticket. When it comes to abortion rights and stuff, he will be more liberal on issues like rape and incest and those sort of exceptions. He will show that he is not of the far right. He's somewhere the center right, but he's happy to have a right-wing guy with him because he wants to keep that part of the party enthusiastic. But he will be very careful about making sure he doesn't get included with the right, because this country is the most pragmatic country in the world. We're very much like... There's only a few other countries like us. We rarely go beyond the 40-yard line. We generally like to see politicians left and right, slightly left of center, slightly right of center. That's what we tend to like. We don't like far left or far right. We just don't. Even Reagan came in. He was a moderate. He was a center-right guy all through the presidency. So Romney, he worked to present Obama as a lefty, himself as a pragmatic, fixing business kind of guy, data miner, engineer of information, not some ideologue. Obama will continue portraying Romney as out of touch with people's real needs. You're going to see so much of this over and over again. And himself as a man who's done smart, necessary things that are beginning to work. Of course, that has to show itself. The debates, I think, are going to be fascinating. I think everybody here will watch them. An hour and a half apiece, 4.5 hours of watching these two guys contend with each other. The greatest opportunity is for Romney because people don't really know him. It's very hard for Barack Obama to present a new Barack Obama, but there's a lot of open space for Romney to show a new personality he hasn't shown yet, a little connecting with real people. He can't say, I just got off the aircraft. He's got to learn how to talk like we do, not like a conehead. That's a real problem for the guy. He talks like a conehead. He's got to stop talking like he's learned earthling first and then get the English right. It's a problem. I don't know where he learned to say, I just got off the aircraft. I don't know what that means exactly. I think I do. But he's got to do that. Romney's great strength is to connect as a fixer, a guy who knows the real challenges facing real people, and he's got the skill set to tackle them. If I were him, I wouldn't try to be popular. I'd just try to be a guy who goes in that speech next week in Tampa and gives a speech about problems affecting people of different categories, older people, younger people, people with out of work, and talk to them personally about the human challenges they're facing, the humiliation of being unemployed or underemployed, the difficulty of owning a home, that the mortgage value is way above the selling price, and you're stuck underwater, especially the young couples. It was in the paper this week. Half the people in this country under 40 are living in homes below the mortgage, the market value below the mortgage, and they're stuck. And that means young people who want to buy a starter house can't buy one because there's none for sale, because people don't want to sell below market. And these are real. How about the student loans? You're looking for a job, and you owe $40,000. And that talk to those people. If I were Romney, I would bring it home to real people and prove I'm not an elitist. I'm talking to real people about real problems. I may not be the warmest guy in the world, but I can connect with real business challenges, and you've got some. I'd talk like that. I'd also treat the president with tremendous respect. None of this Mr. Obama crap. Mr. President, it's very effective. You have to say, Mr. President, you try any snarling stuff of sarcasm or any belittling of the president, you're dead. If I were Romney, I would start off like this. I'd say, Mr. President, you're a good man, you're a good family man, obviously, and I think you're a good American. And you've done everything you could. You had your fiscal policy sold through the Congress, you got your stimulus bill through, you got your health care bill through, and you got some help from the Fed, too. And here we are. That's what I'd do. And here we are. And then I'd pause and I'd say, a little bit of snark, can't resist that. And unless you got something else up your sleeve, why don't you give another fellow a chance? You got to be very human about it. But you can't be sarcastic. That would work. Obama also has to resist cheap shots because everybody will think he's scared he's losing his job. He's clinging to office, as the Brits say. And you can't look like you're so scared of losing your job you're going to be less respectful of your own office than you should be. He should let Romney attack him. Let Romney lace into him. Hit him with everything about the economy. Because there's nothing the American people like more than a guy or a woman who defends themselves in public. The attack from a defensive position is the strongest ploy in military life and in politics. Attack from a defensive position. If I were the president, I would sit there and let him attack me and welt me. And then I would do things like, you know, there you go again. That's how Reagan won the presidency. There you go again. I'm whacking on his old Medicare issue. People root for the guy who's defending his honor. And if Obama can be doing that, and he can trick the other guy into an attack and cut him back with a counterpunch, people will be rooting like hell for him. He can't attack Romney. He's the challenger. The challenger has to attack. It won't work right that way. But if he can get him to attack, you can knock him off. Anyway, there's a lot of things that can happen now in the election that I can't control. Certainly, why did I say that? Of course I can't control. I can't control anything. I'm not even a politician. I watch these characters. There's some things that nobody can control, okay? If we don't get 200,000 jobs a month and start getting numbers like that, start getting back up there instead of, we're at 169 last time. We start getting 200,000 jobs. We don't start getting growth and job creation and start reducing underemployment in this country. It's a tough road for the president to get reelected. We have an unemployment rate coming in the Friday before the election. So from Friday at 8:30 in the morning, when the Labor Department reports 8.5 or 7.8, whatever it is, that's going to be bounced all around by the super PACs. The Koch brothers will be spending $1 zillion over that weekend blasting the bad news out there. They'll do the same, by the way, with a good performance by Romney in the debates. Since this was new this year. If you can break something new right before the election, not the same old attack lines, if you can break something new in this campaign at the end and pay for it with this huge super PAC money, you can really have an impact. And that's what's never been done before. Unlimited money at the last minute to break news against the other candidate. Europe could be, Europe is a problem. Iran, we could be at war. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu keeps talking and saber-rattling every day. We don't know when that's going to happen. If that happens, and Hezbollah attacks from Lebanon, and Hamas attacks from Gaza, what are they going to do about it? The Israelis would then have to invade both areas and start killing civilians. It would be horrendous. So we don't know what kind of chaos is going to be going on if they do the initial attack. All I always say, think of the consequences, think of the chain reaction before you do anything. There's going to be such a chain reaction in that case. I don't know what's going to happen. So, and we also have these odd duck situations developing, like this character who came out of the woodwork named Todd Aiken. I mean, these guys show up. You never know how many of these clowns are going to come out of the closet between, not the closet, that's probably pretty safe, come out of where they come from. The closet's no problem anymore. It's these guys, wherever they hide, when they come out, you never know which one of those odd ducks is going to show up and lose the women vote overnight. By the way, there are more women voters than men, so it's safe not to say, don't say, there ought to be some punishment for rape. That's what the guy said. That was in the paragraph. That was the stuff, the other stuff was so bad they ignored that line. I go, oh, some, well, yeah. Anyway, watch the election. Here's what I think. Here's my pitch tonight. My hope that this election will matter. I think one of the things I learned working for TIP and Jim Baker, Secretary Baker was the top aide to the president, then President Reagan, is that if politicians honor each other's offices, which is very important, they're all elected, treat the other person's office with the same respect as your own, and maybe you'll get it back. Don't treat the other guy as he shouldn't be in your way. Secondly, respect the results of the most recent election and then cut your best deal. This thing about McConnell and all these guys saying, I'm not going to do anything, I'm just going to get rid of this president. That's not democracy. Democracy is letting the people vote, listening to them. If it's a landslide for Romney, the Democrats ought to cut a 60 or a 70-30 deal in the favor of the Republicans. If it's a close election, a 60-40 deal. But everybody should deal according to how the election came out. That's one of the things I've learned working for TIP. Cut the best deal you can, respecting the most recent election. When you win a tough election like 82, demand the Social Security decision be made in your favor with more taxes. But the important thing is you got a deal. And what I don't like about these politicians today is they think all they got to do is go back to their niches, whether they represent Harlem and they can guarantee go to the left, they'll never get defeated. They live in Utah and they can never get defeated, so they go hard right. And they never negotiate, they never compromise, and they never respect the election they just had. I think this election could be very decisive. If Romney wins, he'll probably have 50 senators in the Republican Party. That means he can use reconciliation. That means he can cut taxes and he can cut spending. He can do a lot of what he wants to do maybe the first year with reconciliation with just 50 senators. That's all he needs, and the vice president. So we might have a conservative government next year, a real conservative government by this time, which have already passed its program. That's one option. I think the Democrats should recognize that possibility and cut the best deal they can if it happens. We could also have a very complicated situation where Barack Obama is reelected narrowly with 50 or 51%. The Senate goes the other way, which I really think it's going to go the other way. There's seven possibilities, net possibilities. They could pick up seats and go to 54 on their side. Then he's stuck with a Congress in the other party's hands. That's when you really need to negotiate, and both sides got to recognize it. I know the Tea Partiers don't believe in negotiation. I think they're wrong. I think we elect these people and give them $175,000 a year to go negotiate. That's their job. And I think the American people ought to have the results of their election reflected in government. And anybody who thinks that government breakdown or government lockjam is principled is crazy. So that's my belief. And I think American democracy works wonderfully if the politicians will simply pay attention to who won the election. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Chris Matthews, host of Hardball with Chris Matthews on MSNBC. He was recorded speaking on the U.S. presidential election at the Arctic Imperative Summit in Girdwood on August 25th. Before Chris Matthews, you heard the Honorable Clem Tillion, former chairman of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and Morgan Crow, executive director of the Coastal Villages Regional Fund, speaking on Alaska fisheries, the Bering Sea, and the Arctic. All three presentations were recorded at the Alaska Arctic Imperative Summit in Girdwood on August 25th, 2012. Alaska Dispatch hosted the Arctic Imperative Summit at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood. They also provided audio for this four-part series on KSKA, as well as a complete online video archive of the conference. You can find a link at alaskapublic.org. Next week on Addressing Alaskans at the Arctic Imperative Summit, The Eskimo and the Oil Man, a conversation with author Bob Rees and the Honorable Edward Itta, former mayor of the North Slope Borough. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.